When you need expert help and advice on issues affecting your business, NFU Cymru, we're here for you.
Farmers Guardian is proud to work alongside the Rock and Roll Farming Podcast. For all the latest news and features from across the ag industry, head to fginsight.com. You'll also find a wide variety of advice pieces to help you and your farming business flourish.
Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming.
Hey everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming episode 125. I'm your host, Will Evans, and tonight I'm heading east to Cambridgeshire to talk to arable farmer David Walston. David, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm very, very well. Now, I think we've probably scheduled this interview just in time because we're recording this mid-July and you are due to start harvesting tomorrow morning, you were saying.
Well, we're gonna give it a go. Our combine driver's got a doctor's appointment at 10 o'clock in the morning, so we're going to give a quick go before that and see whether he needs to hurry back or not.
Yeah, okay. I think we'll be going later in the week. So you live just south of Cambridge. What's it like around there? Very, very flat, I suppose.
It is pretty flat around where we are. We've got one thing we call a hill. Most people probably wouldn't call it a hill, but you know, we're sort of clutching at straws.
Yeah,
you don't have to go too far though till it gets a little bit bumpy. But you know, generally, it's the sort of flat plains of South Cambridgeshire, so it's pretty good for farming, but not very good for scenery.
Yes, very, very good farming country, isn't it? For overseas listeners, it is probably the main crop growing area of the UK, isn't it? Though.
Yeah, I mean, us and north, I suppose, going up into Lincolnshire.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is definitely the big area.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So now you live in the farmhouse there now where you were born. We'll go into your family a bit more shortly. But did you grow up wanting to be a farmer?
No, not at all. Yeah, like you say, I literally was born about 20 metres from where I'm sitting now. I spent my younger years at school in Cambridge and then went away to boarding school and then university. And at no point during that time did I ever really want to be a farmer at all.
Never at all? Never entered your consciousness?
Well, it was in my consciousness. I worked on the farm at harvest probably from when I was, I don't know, 15, 16, something like that. Mm-hmm. And my dad would, you know, take me around when I was younger. So I'd sat in a tractor and done things like that. So it wasn't that I didn't know a farm existed. But no, I mean, it wasn't something I wanted to do. I suppose I wanted to be a pilot or something else, but never a farmer.
Yeah. Okay. So you went away to boarding school, as you mentioned, actually to the very prestigious Eton College. And you did have one or two quite famous classmates there, didn't you?
Yeah, I suppose that would probably be fair to say. Yes. Yes, I did. Yeah.
Prince William. It doesn't get much more famous.
Yeah, I suppose that would probably be the most well known. I mean, he obviously always knew who he was and what he was going to become. So that was never a funny thing. The one I've always thought was strange, you know, because you get Etonians becoming politicians and bankers and things like that. But one of the other guys in my class was Eddie Redmayne, and I'd never have in a million years thought I'd have an Oscar-winning actor in the class with me as well. That sort of came out of left field.
Yeah, I could imagine. Yeah, great performance in Birdsong. But do you still keep in touch with those guys?
No would be the short answer. To be honest, I was never sort of close friends with either of those. There were 260 people in a year there, and so you know the chance of being friends with a particular person was fairly low. So I knew them, but never friends then, and not people I know now.
Okay, so you went on to university in London. That must have been a fun few years.
Yeah, it was good. I mean, I was desperate to go to London for some reason. It seems a bit strange now. But, you know, that's just really what I wanted to do when I left university. And most of my friends headed out to Edinburgh, and I thought, well, I'll do something different and go to London. So I went to UCL, which I didn't realize until I got there that actually UCL was the most public school of all the London schools. So I turned out there with quite a few other people I knew. But yeah, no, that was, you know, it was good. I did like being in London.
Yeah. Okay. And studied biology.
Yes. It wasn't actually something I was that interested in by the time I got to university, but I had an excellent biology teacher when I was 16 or 17, whatever lower sixth would have been.
Yeah.
And so that's when I was choosing my subject. So I ended up doing biology.
Okay.
It was okay. It was a sort of easy course. So that suited me quite well.
Okay. So how did you develop an interest in photography?
That's a good question. I was always... I don't know, was I always? I'm not really sure how it started. I did a bit. My dad was always sort of a keen photographer because he used to be a journalist and he liked taking the pictures to go with his articles. And so he always had cameras lying around, that sort of thing. So I did it a bit. And I think then when I went off on my gap year to spend most of the time in South Africa, I think, did he give me a camera then? So maybe I sort of started getting into it at that point.
Okay.
And then when I was at university, I sort of was quite into cars, and I started taking pictures of cars and going to track days and doing pictures there and selling them to the guys driving on them. And so, you know, that's probably where it started.
Yeah. Okay. So what was it you enjoyed about it? Because I'm not great with photography myself, so I always admire people who are good at it. What was it that appealed to you?
I don't know. It's funny because I grew up being told and knowing that I was bad at art. and so, I mean, I found it, I was sort of a science person. So I always thought I was going to end up being a scientist. And then I ended up being a photographer, so basically an artist, and leaving all the science stuff behind. So my life sort of flipped around for quite a long time. But I don't know what it... I don't think there was anything specific I enjoyed. I just like taking nice pictures and you know, the lifestyle it afforded me as a sort of self-employed person when I left university or started my own company and doing that. Just the whole package was quite good for a few years.
Yeah. Okay. So how did you move from it becoming a hobby at university to actually starting a photography business?
So as I sort of mentioned, I started doing the cars and just making a little bit of money there. I think it was sort of my second year of university. And I was kind of tickled by the idea of being a professional photographer, which, you know, I could technically say I was as I'd sold a picture. and so I sort of did that for a bit and then got into interested, and I sort of started teaching a few classes at the University Photographic Society, which was really quite absurd that I was doing that, but I did it, and everyone came and they paid like £1 for a lesson, so I get £6 for doing this or something. So I did that, and I think through that I met a guy who was similar to me. He was was he the year above me at university, but similar age to me, and he had started doing. He was quite an entrepreneurial, more so than me, and he'd managed to get the university to let him take the sports team photos for them, and then, you know, he'd sell them on to the whoever was in the pictures, and, you know, we sort of met up and became friends and decided to start doing photography together, basically. So, you know, he started doing car stuff and I started doing the team photos as well, and it went from there. And so I spent, that was in my second year of university, and I spent more and more time doing photos and less time doing university work. So I sort of did university backwards, you know, doing less work every year rather than more work every year.
But you did manage to graduate, though.
I did graduate. I mean, I got into a real panic because, you know, it got to my finals, and you know, I hadn't been to an awful lot of lectures, and there was one particular one which was at 9 a.m. on a Thursday or whatever. I don't know what day. It was definitely 9 a.m., which in those days was probably the equivalent of about 3 a.m. for me. Yes. Now. And, you know, I made it to about 3 lectures, and they were so boring. It was on developmental or evolutionary biology. They were so boring. I just couldn't pay attention. So I just stopped going. And I got to a month before the finals, and I thought, I better see what this is about. So I went and got all the past papers out, 10 years past papers for this course. And I think there were 15 questions on each one. So there's 150 questions. And I couldn't answer a single thing out of 150 questions. And I thought, this probably not, you know, is not a good look. And I'd managed to kind of wangle a membership to the British Library, which was quite lucky because I couldn't really study at home. The university library was like a zoo. I mean, there was people having paper airplane fights and whatever. Yeah. You know, I don't know what going in it. But the British Library, being a sensible thing, was nice and quiet. And so I could go and sit in there. And I spent a month solidly, you know, going at 9 a.m. to 6 p.m., sort of cramming all the stuff I didn't know, and managed to scrape in with my 2-1. So it sort of looks like I did the work, but it was all stacked in right at the end. So it was a bit lucky escape money.
We're going to take a short ad break now to talk about agricultural weighing specialist Griffith Elder. Griffith Elder specialise in agriculture with their weighing equipment. They design, manufacture here in the UK and supply weigh bridges, portable weigh beams, multi-axle weigh bridges and a host of other weighing equipment for weighing on the farm. The scales are a great way to know how much you've taken from the field and keep track what you have coming in and going out. The portable weigh beams are incredibly easy to install, so no need for any groundworks, and can be placed straight in the yard or moved from store to store as and when you need. All of their scales come with an extensive range of recording equipment options and farm management software, and one very popular piece of kit is their cab fob system, which enables the driver to record the weight of their load without having to leave the comfort of the cab. Built to last for decades, Griffith Elder pride themselves in making simple to install, easy to operate and proven longevity weighing equipment for all their products.
Brilliant. Okay. And then you went straight from university into the photography business.
Basically, yeah, I had a 2-day a week job for a couple of months in an office nearby, just doing some general stuff, doing some accountancy for them, actually, some bank reconciliation stuff, which was kind of bizarre. And they tried to get me to stay, but it was not much fun. I wanted to be an accountant. So I did that for a bit. But basically, shortly me and my partner moved into being full-time photographers. So, you know, that was quite good. So when I tell people I've never had a real job, I've never had to write a CV really or go for an interview or anything like that. That was good. And I did that for, I can't remember, 7 or 8 years probably, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay. And from there, then you started a luxury lifestyle magazine. What's that about? What sort of things would you feature?
So that was pretty good. I met this guy on the internet, on a sort of car site somehow. It's all lost in the mist of time a bit. But he had been working for a publishing company in Stafford and decided that he could sort of do it himself. So we somehow, I can't really remember how now, it seems a bit stupid, but yeah, we decided to start this magazine called Luso, which was a luxury lifestyle magazine. And we could call up the car man, call up Mercedes and say, send us or whatever. And, you know, the car would arrive for a week. Wow. Or probably my best one of those, we got given a Ferrari 59, what was it back then? Can't quite remember what it was now. Some Ferrari anyway. And jeez. I drove it with my dad, who, as I said, used to be a journalist. So he sort of did the writing and I did the photography. We drove that down to Geneva. Wow. Which is pretty cool. And then they flew us back and someone else drove the car back, I guess.
Wow.
So, you know, we did that. We did, I went on a holiday, various holidays. I went and reviewed hotels in Fiji and Tahiti. Did stuff in America, so sort of road trips across America. Got given TVs and whatever to review, that sort of thing. I mean, it was good fun. It was never sort of commercially very successful. but it was good fun to do.
Yeah, must have been pretty fast-paced life, I guess.
I was fitting it in around the, I suppose you could call the day job of doing the photography. And the magazine was a quarterly one. And so we tended to do about 2 months and 3 weeks of mucking around and then have 1 week of insane, sleeping in the office for a week.
Yeah.
My record was 30 hours straight working without going to bed. It's not really a way to run a business. But yeah, it was kind of fun, you know, looking back on it. And when you're young, you can deal with that sort of thing, can't you? I don't think I'd want to do that nowadays.
No. So did you just get to the point eventually where you'd had enough of London life?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I moved there in 2001 because it was just after 9/11. Mm-hmm. And I left right at the end of 2008. So sort of seven years-ish. And the last, I don't know, 2 or 3 years that I was in London, it was a bit of a pain because I had all the negatives of living in London, mm-hmm. you know, the traffic, the expense, all that sort of thing. And I wasn't really making use of any of the benefits. I just wanted to get out and go in the country and that sort of stuff. So, you know, it wasn't that good. She wasn't my wife then, but she got a job in Cambridge, coincidentally. And so we thought, well, this is a good thing. Let's move back out to the farm.
Yeah.
And, you know, we'll live in one of the farmhouses and she can work there. So we did that. You know, this was a bit of a big thing, you know, having got this business in London and we bought an office in Islington and that sort of stuff, you know, through the photography. Mm-hmm. And we had, by that point, we had sort of, I don't know, were there 5 people in the company, something like that. So for me to say, you know, I'm leaving London was quite a big thing. So we did that, you know, we got that all sorted out. She was commuting, Sabrina was commuting up to Cambridge from, where did she live? Oval. So that's sort of South London-ish.
Yeah.
Every day, which wasn't much fun. So she was looking forward to getting up there. And so about 2 weeks before we were out to move, she called me up in floods of tears because she'd just been made redundant. Because it was right, this was 2008, and it was right, she worked in property, and she just had this job for about 2 months at this place in Cambridge, and they just made a whole load of people redundant. So, you know, that wasn't great timing, but actually, you know, it was fine. We still moved out and she got another job in Cambridge, and so, you know, it worked for the best. You know, so I ended up living on the farm, but still, what did I do? I worked from home most of the days and went into London a couple of days a week, which was a bit of a pain. But I slightly fallen out with my business partner a bit, or that's maybe a bit strong. We didn't get on so well anymore, and I was getting very bored of doing wedding photography, which mm-hmm. was our, you know, that was where we made our money.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was photographing probably 40 or 50 weddings a year.
Wow. Okay.
You know, which when I first went to a wedding, the first wedding I ever went to, I was taking photos at. So, I mean, that's somewhat ridiculous. So, you know, it was a pretty big, scary thing at the beginning.
Sure.
But in the end, you know, I'd done hundreds and I went to more weddings in a year than most people go to in a lifetime.
Yeah.
Okay. And they're pretty samey after a while. So I got very bored of that.
I can imagine. So when did you first start to get drawn back to farming?
Well, I wasn't about 3 years after I started farming. So, you know, I was doing the wedding photography stuff, got bored of what I was doing. And so, and not getting on so well with my partner. So I managed eventually to come to an agreement with him and he bought me out, which was quite a painful process to go through. And then, you know, I was left sitting in a house on the farm with nothing to do. And like I said earlier, never ever had a real job or a career or anything like that. So, you know, I really didn't know what I wanted to do at all. And my dad, who's always been very keen, but not sort of doing the hard sell on me coming back to the farm, said, well, why don't you just work on the farm for a year? And I thought, well, you know, all right, why not? No, you know, nothing else going on. So that's how I got back into farming. It was not because I wanted to. It was because I'm lazy, I suppose.
Okay. You have quite the family history there. So why don't you fill us in briefly on that? It was your great-grandfather who bought the farm, right?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, I am, depending on how far you go back, I'm either Scottish, German, American. Well, you know, I've had a sort of transatlantic family that gone back and forth. But my great grandfather on my dad's side bought our farm. He was an academic and he came over from America. And I hope I'm going to get this right. I don't know if my parents are going to listen, but you know, maybe they can tell me off if I get some details wrong. But he came over from America, wanted a house. And so, you know, bought a big house in what's actually a neighboring village from here called Newton Hall. And I guess back then, you know, you bought the house and it just so happened it's got 3,000 acres that comes with it, you know, big garden, all of which is tenanted. So, you know, you were a landowner, not a farmer. So mm-hmm. he did that. And then he died fairly young. And so my grandfather sort of became the boss or whatever when I think he was in his 20s. And did that. But he, for whatever reason, I think was just interested in farming.
Okay.
And I mean, during the Second World War, he was involved in arranging agricultural machinery and stuff for the Germans after the war to sort of get them back on their feet.
Yeah.
So he had an interest in agriculture. And so when the tenants started retiring, instead of, you know, putting out new AHA leases or whatever, finding new people, he started taking the farm back in hand and doing that sort of slowly bit by bit. But he was never, I wouldn't imagine, or I don't think he ever got his hands dirty. He never, you know, drove a tractor or milked a cow or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But they built up a fancy Jersey pedigree dairy herd and Charolais beef cattle and, you know, all this sort of stuff that is pretty to look at, but probably not commercially very sensible, same as now.
Yeah, okay. And your dad, your father, Oliver Wolston, very prominent farmer in the UK, and anyone with any connection to farming here will have heard of Oliver Wolston, if nothing else through the fact there was a TV show called Against the Grain made about him in the late 90s, was it? What's it like to have such a well-known father, and does that bring a certain pressure?
I mean, I often get people saying, oh, are you Oliver's son, mm-hmm. whatever, which, you know, the answer is normally it depends who's asking or do you like him or not. I mean, back when he made that program, it was generally about the subsidies he got, that we all got.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd go on and say, I mean, I think there was a bit in the program where he goes, I've just had a check for £120,000 for doing nothing, thanks a lot, or, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
Which went down sort of well with the TV producers, but didn't go down well with quite a lot of farmers.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I distinctly remember sitting around at home, you know, on the evenings these TV programs had gone out, and getting sort of anonymous threatening phone calls, you know, ringing up and going, you shut the, you know, what are you doing?
Yeah.
You know, you're ruining our lives and uh-huh. all this sort of stuff. So back then there was a lot of, hostility towards it, which I think with time has tempered.
Yes.
I don't, you know, and now, because my dad is not sort of active particularly anymore. He's not in the public eye.
Mm-hmm.
Now I think people look back maybe more fondly and maybe forget the, or at least they don't say things to me anyway. whereas, you know, I did used to hear stuff. I remember randomly bumping into a guy in where on earth was that, somewhere in like Tanzania or something, when I was about 18, and he sort of found out who I was, and he was then just slagging off my dad to everyone around. Wow. Right in front of me, basically.
Okay.
You know, so it did happen, but people don't do that now, I suppose. It's you know, a bit like maybe if you ask people in France in the 60s, you know, were you in the French Resistance? And everyone claimed they were. Now everyone claims they're a fan of his.
Yeah.
But, you know, it certainly wasn't the case. But, you know, yes, he is well known. And so he gets everyone always asks after him and how he's doing and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, is there pressure from it or anything? I don't think so particularly. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not the same as him in that, you know, I'm not desperate to be on TV and do that sort of stuff, which was what he really enjoyed.
Yeah.
So, you know, we don't move in the same sphere, and we certainly don't farm in the same way, that's for sure.
Okay. And was he happy, though, when you did come back to the farm?
I believe so, yes. It'd be pretty difficult to say, because as you might, I don't know, you might know, these things often, you know, they're not said. But I do get that impression. And I did actually, I mean, to give him credit, you know, it sort of turned out later that he had been really keen for me to go to agricultural college and do all this stuff and come back to the farm or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I never felt any of that pressure at all. So that was good. You know, he was, although he might not have been happy, I went off and doing my own thing. You know, he was very supportive of me being a photographer, and he got me started and interested in photography and everything like that. So yes, he was keen,
yeah.
But there was never any pressure.
No, okay. So how long did it take you to settle into the farming life?
Well, I enjoyed the job from the start. So, you know, I didn't do what some people I know and some of my friends do, which, you know, is come back to the family farm having been a photographer or a, you know, or a bank or whatever, and become the boss and go and start telling people how to farm, you know, which I always think is just ridiculous, really. I mean, it's how politics works and the government works. And we see, you know, we see where that leads us. So, I didn't do that. So I started from day one, you know, on the bottom rung. You know, it's not a big farm, and there's two people plus me and my dad. But you know, there's two people actually work on the ground, and so you know, I did that. So I got pretty good with a shovel and a brush. the guy who's the manager, who's you know still around now, he's been with us a very, very long time, does a great job. He's not brilliant at delegating, and so I think it took over a year before I was allowed on the loader to load a lorry. So I did lots of sweeping down the sides, and we've got an old grain store, which has got, it was designed in the 50s and 60s to store for seed production. So we've got one grain store that's got 26 50-ton bins in it, which need 7 or 8 tons of the bottom shoveling out.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, we did a lot of that sort of stuff. I learned to spray. And did whatever. So, you know, I did enjoy that. I like being outside. I like and still do like the variety of a farming life, you know, doing different things all the time throughout the year. So, you know, that was great. I like the day-to-day, but I definitely was not really interested in the agronomy or, you know, the actual farming side of it. You know, I was quite happy to just go home at night and watch TV and do whatever, you know, it would leave my mind, just like a normal job, I suppose. So, you know, it was a gradual thing after that, that I became more and more interested. You know, there wasn't a kind of eureka moment. I remember at one point my dad saying, oh, will you go and have a look at this controlled traffic farming thing? You know, and there's this course going on. Why don't you go on that and see what it's about? So, you know, I looked at that and then looked at direct drilling and all these sort of things. And I thought about it for a while and just became more and more interested gradually. And then I suppose, I was jumping ahead a bit, but I went on honeymoon to Japan and ate some of the sort of famous Wagyu beef, the Kobe beef that we all hear about. And so I thought this was delicious. So then when I got back home, I thought, you know, well, how can we get some of this here? Because it's so different to anything we can get. And the answer back then was, you know, you can't really. There were probably two herds in the country and no one was selling anything. And you can buy, Wagyu semen, but obviously all your clever farming listeners will know that Wagyu semen only makes half a Wagyu cow. You know, you need the other half. So my sister, who's a vet, said, well, why don't you buy some embryos, which I didn't know existed. So I looked online and discovered you could buy embryos. So I did that. I bought some from America at not in considerable expense, and got them over here and got a nasty bill for customs import that was a bit of a shock, and all the handling. I mean, you import these things and they come on a freight plane, and they get you have to then get a cargo handler or whatever, and then they send you a bill for £800 and go, you know, you need to pay this because, and here's the itemization, like £125 for transport from the plane to the warehouse. You know, and you can't argue with it because you know that there is no option. You know, so I got these embryos at big expense, bought some Simmental heifers to put them in, bung three in, none of them worked, and I thought, oh, you know, what have I done? What a disaster. Bunged another three in, and those worked. So I end up with some Wagyu cows. Or some Wagyu calves, rather, I should say. And from there, you know, that sort of got me more into farming because I had to learn about cattle. And from the cattle, I then started to think about grass and soil and that sort of thing. I guess that was sort of my intro into being, you know, more interested in the whole farming system rather than just looking at a tractor or a piece of GPS equipment or whatever. You know, that was the main Kickstarter.
And it was it from there that you decided to do a Nuffield scholarship?
Yeah, that was when I started thinking about soil, because like I say, I had to get some books, because I'd never really touched a cow before I bought these heifers. Mm-hmm. So it was a bit of a steep learning curve. So I went on Amazon and typed in cow farming or whatever I did, and got the first three books, that came up. And one of them was this book, can't think what it was, by a Canadian sort of hippie cowboy farmer. And it was all about how to grow grass without any input, or how to grass feed cattle without really using any inputs. So it wasn't specifically an organic book, but it was kind of beyond organic, really, I suppose. And that was quite interesting. And that really did just start to make me think about the soil specifically. Because I thought that was sort of intriguing. You know, here's this system where he's saying, you can get better production. You can beat a conventional system for production without putting in any inputs. And I thought, well, that sounds pretty nifty.
Yeah.
Because, we do spend a lot on inputs. Uh-huh. That's where it started. I started noticing, not that this is rocket science at all, but that some of our fields are better than other fields. You might think then, some people don't, but I thought, why is it better? And how can we make, the bad fields like the good fields? And that kick-started the interest. And, the difference obviously was the soil. The weather's the same from, one field next to the other one. How can we make our fields better? How can we improve our soils? I then went to Nuffield Scholarship on that. I'd actually, about two or three years before, I'd been turned down a Nuffield Scholarship on cattle farm, Wagyu farming.
Had you? Okay.
So yeah, I went through the process twice, or I didn't actually go through the whole process, because the first time they canned me right in the off and didn't get past the first stage. I did that in 2014 and 15, I suppose that was, yeah.
Okay. I did watch your presentation last night, and yes, it was very interesting. You talked about how the importance of grass in the rotation, how the fields that were better because they'd had grass in the rotation more recently than others.
Yeah, I it's not really rocket science,
no,
is it?
You know,
you look back at you look at systems before we had fertilizer and pesticides that come out of a bag and a bottle.
Mm-hmm.
They figured out through trial and error how to make it work. If I'm here now thinking, how do we want to make our farm work without giving so much money to BASF and Yara and all those mm-hmm. guys, obviously, logically, you're going to be looking towards that sort of system, which obviously, organic does a bit with fertility building lays and that sort of thing. But yeah, having grass in there, that is the one thing. My scholarship really, Nuffield Scholarship really hinged on putting carbon back in the soil.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of things we do on our farm that kind of fiddle around the edges. But if you want to put carbon back in the soil, you've got to have perennial plants there, because the carbon comes from the roots.
Sure.
It doesn't come from the leaves or the stuff above ground that looks pretty. It comes from the roots, primarily because they literally exude carbon into the soil
mm-hmm.
to, as part of a symbiotic relationship to feed soil life. And so they're putting carbon in, and plus when they die and break down, they're breaking down in the soil rather than on top of the soil where most of it disappears in the air. And if you want big roots for that, then you need perennial plants. By definition, perennial plants have bigger roots than annual plants. The only way of getting perennials into a system like we're doing, assuming we're not going to grow a forest, is to have grass, really. The question is what you do with the grass and how do you make money with it?
Yeah. So when did you start putting that into practice on the farm? Because it's quite easy to change a system that's been in place for quite a long time, isn't it? That's quite a difficult thing.
Yeah. I sort of luckily had cattle at the time. I don't have cattle now. I built up with the Wagyu. At the end, I had, I can't remember, between 50 and 60 head of cattle. They weren't uh-huh. all Wagyu. About half of them were Wagyu. The other half were embryo recipients. I had these cows here, and I had to have somewhere to graze them, And so, yeah, we've got a few little grass paddocks around, but it wasn't enough for that number.
No.
And so I turned one of our arable fields into a herbal lay, I suppose what we'd call it. So, you know, it had a mix of grasses. It had ryegrass and cockswort and timothy. And then we added sandfoin and trefoil and various white clovers and red clovers and chicory and all that sort of thing. So we did that, and I would then mob graze it. You know, which I had various friends who were big mob grazers. And mm-hmm. Tom Chapman, I don't know if you know him, he's sort of fairly near me. He's a big mob grazer.
Mm-hmm.
I used to know Neil Dennis, who was a sort of pioneer mob grazing guy, who I visited in Canada. Unfortunately, he died a year or two ago, which is a shame because he was, you know, one of the sort of world experts on mob mm-hmm. grazing. So, you know, I did this, and we, you know, we'd move the cows once a day. Through different cells on this field, which actually, you know, worked really well because I set the field up from the beginning to make my life easy for that sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know, so I could go out in a quad bike and set up 16 cells in about an hour and a half. And then, you know, every day you just go and unwind a wire and let them in the next one. So it was pretty quick. So I did that, and, spent 3 years doing that basically. And that was, when was that? Probably from 2014 to 2014, 15, 16, I think. Okay. And the idea really there was to see in that time whether I could. So I got these sort of group of three fields you would have seen in my presentation yesterday. And they're all next to each other. And one of them's really good and the other two are not so good.
Yeah.
And so I put the grass lay on one of the not so good ones to see whether in those 3 years I can make it more like the good one than its, you know, neighboring, not very good one, if that makes any sense. So we did the 3 years and then came out of that, and we've had two crops off that since then. But it's really a bit too early to tell, you know, whether it's worked or not. Unfortunately, all these things, when we're looking at the soil, they take quite a long time yes. to, you know, to have an effect, yeah. which isn't what everyone says. There's quite a few guys out there who will tell you, you know, you can transform your soil in 2 years by going no-till and yeah. cover crops and whatever, which is, in my opinion and experience, under complete rubbish. You know, you can't do that. So all these things take years to look at.
Mm-hmm.
And, it, you know, it's difficult to compare as well, isn't it? You know, even fields next to each yeah. other. Different things happen different years and whatever.
Hmm.
But yeah, you know, that's what we're doing. So I don't have any animals on the farm at the moment, which is a relief.
so it was an experiment, really, with the cattle. You never planned to keep them.
So the Wagyu was not intended as an experiment. It was sort of intended as a fun thing. And
yeah.
then it sort of got bigger. And I got to the point with the 60 animals where it was as a phrase comes to mind, it's probably not suitable for your family friendly audience, but you know, I thought I've either got to go big or go home.
Yes,
I suppose
sure.
that'd be a friendlier way of saying it.
Yeah.
You know, am I going to have 300 animals and probably employ someone who actually knows what yeah. they're doing, or am I going to have zero? Because I was stuck in the middle, and it was, you know, I did not find it fun. I started it for fun, mm-hmm. and it was not fun. So they basically I had a lot of soul searching. It was a really difficult decision,
mm-hmm.
but I decided to get rid of them in the end. And actually that was only 2 years through our 3 year lay. So maybe it was only a year and a half of the way through, I think it was. So for two summers, I actually grazed that thing with some sort of young dairy cattle, dairy heifers, they were dairy cross things that were coming out and then going in for meat production after.
Okay.
That's right. So I had some B&B cattle in to graze them.
Okay.
So, you know, it was, the cattle weren't intended as an experiment, but the 3 year lay was an experiment,
yeah, sure.
you know, because we did actually, you know, we did make some money off that. Not a lot, but, you know, we made a bit of money. And so we need to see whether the return from soil improvement, that's where we would make the real money,
mm-hmm.
not the few hundred pounds a hectare we'd make, you know, having the animals on this. Mm-hmm. And we did increase the organic matter content from 3% to 4.5% in 3 years.
Did you?
Which, you know, is a good thing.
Yeah.
Well, I said, you know, all things being equal is a good thing. It will only be a confirmed a good thing if we actually get a return from it.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, there's one of my sort of bugbears with farming and farming in the sort of conservation agriculture world is that you see all these metrics that people do, you know, like smelling their soil. You know, our soil on our farm smells a lot better than my neighbor's does that plows. You know, mm-hmm. That is a fact. They're, you know, the plowed soil doesn't smell of anything. Our one smells deeply soilish.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you don't sell the smell, do you?
No.
You sell what comes off it. And so actually, do I want smelly soil? Well, it sort of makes me feel better, but it might not make any money. You know, there's lots of tests like that. The slake test, you know, the soil texture analysis, all this sort of stuff that people point to and go, well, look, no-till's better. You know, I'm pretty skeptical about that sort of thing. So, you know, what I'm trying to say is, you know, the fact we've increased the organic matter is not going to matter at all if we don't make more money at the end of it.
Yeah. Are you encouraged, though, that soil is suddenly a subject that's on everyone's lips, from farmers right through to politicians? Do you think that's important?
I do think it's important. The problem is, and I sound a bit sort of negative here, really, but the problem is we don't understand it at all, not even close. You know, soil is such, and how it relates to farming is so incredibly complex that we don't get anywhere close to understanding it. Mm-hmm. You know, the when you apply science to farming, they're uncomfortable bedfellows, because obviously in a, you know, conventional reductionist science, the whole idea is you reduce take away all the variables apart from the one thing you're looking at, and then you can see, you know, what difference that makes. But unfortunately with farming, you can't do that.
No.
You know, you might take away 10 variables, you know, your drilling date, your variety, yeah, or whatever, all this sort of stuff. But, you know, you've then got the weather, you've got the soil type, you've got the particular bacteria that live in your soil, the particular fungi that live in your soil, how they all interact together. And, you know, it's a web that's so complex that we can't do it. And for me, farming is actually, it's an art that can be led by science, because to me, art is just science that's too complicated for humans to understand. You know, at the end of the day, everything is science. If you take it down to the base level, to the atoms and the quarks and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But once you build up such layers of complexity, although it's still science, you know, our brains work by science, but
yeah,
they're too complicated for us to understand. And that's where art comes in. Art is science that's too complicated to understand. And that is farming. And so, yes, you know, we can use science a little bit, but at the end of the day, a lot of it comes down to experience and looking at what works on your farm. You know, that's the biggest critical thing, is you can't rely all the time on what someone else tells you is the right thing to do. You've got to try stuff on your own farm.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, speaking of that then, your own farm, you have a really, really good website. I think is it triplofarms.co.uk?
It's pronounced Triplo, but it's spelled Triplo.
Okay.
Yeah, so if I say it easy, yeah, it's Triplo-farms.co.uk, if we're going to be precise.
Okay, and you publish on there an annual report on your farming operation and a monthly blog post about what's going on the farm at that time. Why do you choose to do that?
The annual report, I didn't ever choose to do. My dad started it in 1974, I think.
Okay.
And then, so I came back to the farm in 2009, and my dad actually had a stroke that year, or was it the year after? I think it was the first year I was back, so actually 2010. And he continued to write it for a bit, but he then sort of, you know, he said to me, you know, well, I want you to write it. And I really had no desire. In fact, I had quite a strong anti-desire, if you understand what I mean, for writing it. And then, you know, so he sort of wrote it himself 1 year. So that was probably 2010 or 2011. And then he goes, oh, well, fine, I'm not going to write it then. And sort of guilt tripped me into writing it, basically, because I didn't want the tradition to die. Because it was quite a big thing. You know, I remember it's quite easy now because I publish it on the web and you just email everyone a link.
Yeah.
I remember when I was a kid, you know, him printing out a billion copies and posting all these individually, you know, out to all four corners of the world.
Yeah.
You know, so it was a, it's been a sort of family tradition for quite a long time. And yeah, something that I didn't want to disappear. And it's something I quite enjoy. I mean, I've probably written 7 now, something like that. I don't know, but something like that. And I think probably if you took the time to read each one, you'd probably notice me starting to enjoy writing them a bit more.
Yeah.
And the style changing, that sort of thing, as you went through. But they're, you know, they're about 3,000 or 4,000 words each, so it's not a blog post. It's a bit more substantial than that.
Yeah, definitely. And you do add a bit of wit into it. I messaged you last night because I very much enjoyed your reference to Common People by Pulp in one of them.
Well, I'm glad you took it that way. Some people, notably my wife, thought that was a possibly slightly offensive comment, which I thought anyone who took it in a literal way is probably missing the point. But, you know, some people do. But, you know, it's always been something that, you know, it's not aimed at farmers specifically. Mm. You know, I want it, and my dad always did it this way. I want it something that my non-farming friends read. And I know, you know, they do, because I send it out and, you know, most of them, you know, come back. Now I can actually see who's read it as well, the way it's done. So that's quite good. So I can sort of prompt people to read it if they haven't done, which I'm sure goes down well. You know, but yeah, it's not meant to be a dry technical thing of, you know, this is what we sprayed on this field or whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it hopefully goes to a bit of a wider audience.
Yeah, it's definitely engaging. So you also on the website, speaking of that, have what's in that field section, which combined with the walking routes you have for the public is, I think, really refreshing approach. Do you get a good response from this?
Yeah, I do generally. I mean, I find it highly bizarre, the what I consider to be the standard farmer attitude to the public, which is incredible suspicion when somebody wants to know what's going on. Mm-hmm. You know, I've seen it, or, you know, someone stops by the road and takes a picture of a tractor, and the farmer's like, well, what's that person doing? You know, why are they taking a picture of my tractor? What, you know, it's just very bizarre. And someone asks a question and they're, you know, very defensive and don't want to say. Mm-hmm. I come from a family that's been open about the farming always, but also, you know, come from my slight non-farming background. Mm-hmm. I think it's totally natural to want to know what's going on. And, you know, the public are often suspicious of farmers as well a bit, because they get this attitude back. And so I prefer to be open with people. And so, you know, I think it just hopefully engenders a better relationship. You know, with people, they want to know what's going on out the back of their house. You know, why is that tractor doing this? Or asking why are you spraying that field should not be something that, you know, prompts a defensive response. It should be we're doing it because X, Y, Z. And if you don't have a reason that doesn't make you angry, then maybe you shouldn't be doing it.
Do you think it's more important than ever that we try to do that kind of thing as farmers and food producers?
No, I think it's probably equally as important as ever. Okay. I don't know. It's always been important.
Yeah.
I suppose now with social media as it is and whatever, you know, it's easier for anti-farming things or misinformation to be spread. So maybe it is more important. But it's difficult. You know what farming Twitter's like. You know, it's quite big, but it's often farmers telling other farmers how they farm. You know, how much does it penetrate to the wider world? I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So tell us about the new project that you've started.
Yeah, we've had an agronomist for, I know she's been working with us probably 10, 15 years now, but she recently moved company she moved to AgriVista, but they started up this new sort of wing of AgriVista called Agronomy Connection. And so we're working with them. And, you know, I've talked about it a bit already. We farm in a conservation agriculture way. So, you know, that means the no-till cover crops, all that kind of boring stuff that people bang on about on Twitter all the time. you know, but we do, you know, a focus on that, on trying to build soil health and all these buzzwords, but also, you know, reducing chemical usage, insecticides, fungicides, whatever, all these things. But the problem we've come across, because, you know, we've been farming like that for about 5 years now, but all of the, I mean, literally all of the farming advice and the research that's done at the moment is done in a conventional farming system. And, you know, some of the times that's fine, but other times, you know, you're really sort of stabbing in the dark because you're thinking, well, you know, I know what the conventional advice is, but I'm really not sure that's appropriate for our system. And there's nothing out there apart from, you know, trying it yourself a bit, which can be difficult, or asking someone, you know, have you done this before? Whatever, you know, there's nothing out there to kind of inform what we're doing. So we set this thing up with Agronomy Connection in a very small way this year, and getting bigger, you know, in the following years, where we're going to be looking at research and techniques specifically for conservation agriculture, you know, and how the agronomy advice should be different in those systems. So, you know, I think it's something quite exciting. Like, just to give a sort of basic example, you know, we would use in a conventional system, you know, you plant your wheat in October, whenever it is, and then you've probably cultivated it, so you've got some bare soil showing. You plant it, and then you come and you spray your pre-emergent herbicide on, and that stops your weeds coming up on the soil. Now, you know, we do the same thing in our conservation agriculture system. The difference is sometimes, you know, we're drilling into, instead of drilling into bare soil or some stubble, we might be drilling into 2 feet tall oilseed rape volunteers. And so, you know, you've got this big mat, and then you come back maybe a week later and spray it off and put your pre-emergent herbicide on. But you're not spraying onto bare soil where it's been tested and where people know it to work. You're spraying it onto 2 feet of, you know, lush green stuff. And so the question is, you know, is that sensible? Does it work? Should we be doing the timing differently? Should we, what, you know, who just, we don't know. And just looking at it, it might turn out that the advice is the same, but I can very easily imagine, you know, it's such a different system. What's the best way of doing it? I don't know. So that's the only way we're going to find out, is by doing proper trials into this sort of thing and making all the research, the results public as well. You know, it's not a proprietary thing.
Fantastic. So this is on your farm?
Yeah, it'll be on our farm, yes. I mean, this year we've just done, we've done some fungicide trials and some fertilizer timing trials, because we only started it in, only sort of agreed to do it in January, February time. So it's pretty limited, you know, what we could do halfway through the season. But we'll be looking at a lot more stuff. And it's on the farm, and we will hopefully be running open days and that sort of stuff, people to actually come along and see what we're doing.
Yeah, I was going to say, I would imagine there'll be a lot of interest in that from right the way around the world.
Hopefully. And, you know, it's, although we're, you know, we're going to be yielding it properly, the things that need yielding, you know, with a plot combine, and getting replicated areas, and so we can get something statistically robust out of it. But, you know, it's being, this is sections being taken out of fields that are farmed in a, you know, in a proper commercial way. It's not a load of small plots that are done with machinery that isn't applicable, you know, to an actual real farm. You know, it's done properly, but just proper results taken from that. So, you know, it should be as relevant as it can be, with the caveat, like I said earlier, you know, just because it works on my farm doesn't mean it's going to work on your farm.
No.
You know, but you've got to start somewhere, and then, you know, take these things and then tweak them for your own location.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose, as you mentioned earlier, these things take a number of years. So, I mean, that's going to be ongoing for the foreseeable future, I suppose.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, so, you know, some things you can see fairly quickly, but there's always different seasons, aren't there? You can do one thing and you think that's great, and then the next season it rains a lot more or a lot less or whatever, and the same thing doesn't work. So yeah, you probably need, you know, generally I'd have said at least 3 years to be starting to get a bit of a handle on it, and ideally, you know, it keeps going. And I suppose that's another problem with academic research. You know, they get grant funding for a 3-year project or something. You know, you don't get grant funding for a 20-year project into arable rotations or something, because they've all got bored of it by then.
Yeah, no, exactly. Farming is a long-term game. Right. Okay, then, David, this has flown by. So we will end this in the traditional way with the hard-hitting questions, if you're ready.
Yeah. Okay, go for it.
What's your all-time favourite song?
Yeah, that's a difficult one. I mean, obviously, like you, I'm sure we're quite partial to some Taylor Swift. But, you know, I don't think yeah, good. I don't think I'd probably go with that. And then, you know, I was thinking back, well, my first album I ever bought when I was about 13 was Belinda Carlisle. So I quite like that. And Heaven is a Place on Earth is a classic. But then probably going back even further, I think my favorite's got to be from the king of the movie soundtracks, Kenny Loggins, and you know, his best ever song, just pipping Danger Zone, would be Playing with the Boys. So I think there would have to be that. That'd be brilliant. My favorite.
Brilliant. Love a bit of Top Gun. Okay. You're hosting a dinner party for you and three guests. Anyone from history, alive or dead? Who are you having?
Probably, I don't know, have you ever seen Mythbusters?
Yes.
You've watched that program?
Yes, yeah.
I saw Adam Savage from Mythbusters. Yeah. Always seemed like a bloody interesting and nice guy. So
yes,
I'd probably have him. Jesus, I think, would be a good one, because I would love to see his reaction when he saw what had happened to, you know, how much these stories of his life had been blown totally out of proportion.
Yeah.
You know, he'd probably be like, you remember that time you had a picnic? By the way, now everyone thinks that you fed 5,000 people with a tin of anchovies. So, you know, that'd be quite fun to see his face. And thirdly, probably Alicia Cuthbert, who was played Kim Bauer in 24. But I've always wanted to meet her for, I'm not sure the reason exactly. But yeah, so those would be my three.
That would be an excellent dinner party. Okay, you've done a lot of travelling to various countries, as you've mentioned. What's your favourite place that you visited and why?
Definitely Japan, my favourite country. Home of the Wagyu beef, home of the sushi. Which, that sounds ridiculous, home of the sushi. Makes me sound like an imbecile. But anyway, I've said it now. Back when I was a super fussy eater when I was a kid, I always loved sushi, right from the, you
did
know,
you?
From okay. as long as I can remember, which is a bit weird. My kids do as well, actually. So, you know, that I love all Japanese food. I love the culture. I love going there. I've been four or five times, I think, but not for quite a long time now.
Uh-huh.
And so, yeah, I just, you know, it's a place I always enjoy going. And, you know, they are more obsessed with food than any other culture I've ever been in. So that sort of chimes quite well with my interests as well.
Definitely. Okay, what's the best piece of advice you've ever been given?
That's a good one. And something I neglected to come up with a good answer for first. So I'm going to have to come up with something now. Best piece of advice I've ever been given. Probably read the questions on the exam paper first. probably appropriate for this situation.
Yeah, okay. And lastly then, what's your favorite agriculture related social media account to follow?
Let's see whether you count this as agriculture related. George Monbiot.
That's interesting.
Definitely George Monbiot. Yep. I mean, it's I agree with something like 80 or 90% of what he says.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very uncomfortable agreement. Because, mm-hmm. you know, you probably see at least some of what he says, and it's not, you know, the sort of stuff he talks about isn't tinkering around the edges.
Yeah.
He's basically sort of suggesting sledgehammer to the entire Western culture and lifestyle. And a lot of it, you know, I find difficult to disagree with.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's the side of me that's sort of relieved about that because, well, not relieved about it, but he's so extreme. I just think, well, that's not going to happen. You know, it's not possible. It might need to happen,
mm-hmm.
But it's not going to. So, you know, you've sort of got this dichotomy in your brain where half of me is thinking it needs to happen and the other half's thinking, phew, thank God it won't happen because, you know, that would be quite difficult.
Yes.
No. And I like going on holiday. So, yeah, that would be it.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. I've seen him speak and I've met him actually. He's a really nice guy, but yeah, he certainly makes you think with the things he says, doesn't he?
Yes.
So, excellent answer. Okay, David, it's been brilliant to talk to you. Thanks for taking the time to share your farming story with us, and good luck with a new project. And hopefully, I'll bump into you somewhere soon.
Yeah, that will be good. Yeah, you're welcome here anytime you're around.
Brilliant. Well, hopefully, I can come and visit the new project. I think it'd be fascinating.
That would be good. See you here.
Cool. Good luck with harvest.
Thank you. You too.
And to everyone at home, thanks for listening and hope to see you next time. I've been Will Evans. This has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you and good night.